Welcome to Night School, taking a stab at the Middle Ages.
A podcast devoted to medieval history and culture, and the occasional bad pun.
I'm Becca, bringing you everything related to medieval religion and church history.
And I'm Claire, covering all things medieval literature and history.
Today we're going to be talking about medieval childhood. I think that it's going to be a really interesting conversation because there is a lot of really interesting scholarship on this topic, and I think it's a very fitting first topic because for some reason, I don't know why, but Becca and I make a lot of jokes about babies. Like, I think that is like the foundation of our friendship. So,
this is
funny
true.
Story. Funny story. One of my tutorials was called Women in Literature in the Middle Ages. And in one of the first few weeks, I read The King of Tars, which has a lump of flesh baby in it. And we kind of just came to the consensus that it was Blob Baby. And so every time I would go to that tutorial every week, Becca would call it Blob Baby Tutorial. And it just stuck. And she ended up, like, we ended up just sticking with it. Like, oh, yeah, this is for Blob Baby. Or, like, it was kind of weird, but
it sounds, you know, weirder with you like recounting the tale now.
I know, but hopefully our listeners like have a sense of humor.
Yeah.
And to begin the episode, we found some really interesting descriptions of medieval babies. Kind of funny, not super historically accurate, but.
No.
Here's a quote from an article that we were reading. Ugly might be too weak a word for medieval babies. These babies look like horrifying tiny men with high cholesterol and strong opinions about housing association rules. So yeah, that's kind of going to set the scene for our more in-depth discussion of medieval babies.
Yeah, amazing. So one of the things we wanted to mention up front was that we're going to attempt to weave in information from a variety of sources covering different geographies, but many of the descriptions of childhood that will follow are more skewed towards medieval Europe and particularly medieval England and more middle-class families. So just like today, the experience of childhood in the medieval world widely varied, but we hope this episode will serve kind of as an introduction or glimpse into some of these experiences.
Yes, totally agree. Yeah, and so we're going to start off the discussion with talking about the misconception. His name is Philippe Aries or Aries. I've heard so many different people pronounce it differently, but we're going to say Aries for the episode because it's easiest to pronounce. But, yeah, so he was a 20th century French historian who wrote books on daily life and Western perceptions of death over time. And he was actually pals with Foucault, and I'm pretty sure Foucault wrote his obituary, fun fact. But he wrote a book called Centuries of Childhood, and that was translated into English in 1962. And probably the claim that he's most known for, because it is a very bold claim and did kind of set off a bunch of research into this topic. He says there was no place for childhood in the medieval world, which that is a very bold claim. And he claimed that in the Middle Ages, infants and small children were neither noticed nor acknowledged, and their parents didn't really treat them as small individuals and just kind of treated them like mini adults. And he also claimed that because of that and because of how frequently they died and just a bunch of different, like, perceptions of how, like, the family unit was perceived in the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. he claimed that parents didn't get as emotionally attached to their children. So, yeah, that's kind of some of the major claims from what he was saying. And like I said, he also claims that the family wasn't a vital social unit, and, like, the essential units were more revolved around communities of lower-class workers on one hand and the well-to-do households on the other, and life was more conducted in public. He also claims that after infancy, there was no distinction of child or adolescence from adults, and there's no really awareness of any essential differences between those age groups. And by the end of the 15th century is when he starts to say that the child became more of a source of, like, I don't know, tininess, amusement. It's the first time we could acknowledge a concept of childhood. And a lot of his examples come from medieval art. And he, interestingly, this is probably the most interesting, even though I do, and a lot of people disagree with it, the way that he presents the argument, it was really interesting to read. Mm-hmm. He says that medieval art until about the 12th century didn't know childhood or attempt to portray it. And he also kind of says that's true for the 13th century, but also in the 13th century, some artistic portrayals were starting to become closer in line with how we view children. And I read in an article, I think it by Sophie Oosterwijk.
Yeah.
We have a lot of long last names for this episode, but she points out that, like, medieval art's objective wasn't realism in a modern sense.
Right.
And that maturity depicted in art wasn't necessarily the expectation in daily life. And the reason why, like, medieval art was appealing was because of its unnaturalness.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, a lot of scholars kind of took his work as certainty at the same time, and they, like, started their research at, like, 1500. And there's a lot of neglect at looking at childhood as existing in the medieval period. So we also read a lot of Barbara Hannawalt's scholarship, mm-hmm. because she's amazing, I guess. And
another big source for this topic, I would say.
Exactly. We can post the titles to everything we referenced after. Mm-hmm. And another reason, like I said, that Philippe Ares was making all these claims was because of how frequently children died. But the thing with infant mortality rates in the Middle Ages, most of what we know is overshadowed by that. So,
mm-hmm.
like, the chief records for studying childhood in London specifically came from wardship cases that appear in letter books.
Right.
So because of that, most of what we know about children are children who lost a parent or more commonly a father.
Mm-hmm.
And everything else also came from, like, coroner's inquests and wills. So the sources are pretty skewed toward groups of children who were statistically more likely to not make it. But based off of these sources, people estimate that infant mortality rate was 30 to 50% in the pre-modern world. But even this statistic is representative of the higher classes. And because we don't have parish registers for the Middle Ages, there's not an accurate estimate of the actual number of children who died, which I feel like if we did have, I don't know, you can disagree with me, but if we did have some more records, then the scholarship would definitely evolve or change, or people's opinions would change. I don't know, but
yeah, no, I would agree with that. And I feel like, too, that percentage doesn't really give much information, like you said, with that it's more skewed towards children who were orphans and things like that, but it also doesn't really identify the ages that they were dying at.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, for example, the other scholar who we also read, Nicholas Orme, he was specifying more England from 500 to 1500 CE, but he kind of broke it down, estimating 25% mortality rate for infants in their first year, and then it kind of halves to 12.5% for children 1 to 4, and a 6% mortality rate for 5 to 9-year-olds. So I think that's interesting to see kind of that it wasn't just infants' first years, but also that the 30 to 50%, like this higher mortality rate estimate, we don't really know what that encompasses in terms of, like, their age range. So there are, I think you're right, that there's a lot of different estimates out there that maybe we need better sources to have, like, a more clear perspective of what they really represent.
Right. And also, I think from the same source, the scholar says that we know far more about, like, in some cases, about, like, peasants' children's life experiences, mm-hmm. because of, like, the coroner's data on country children's accidental deaths, which
right.
we can definitely talk about in a minute, mm-hmm. or so they happen so often because children had more freedom to, like, roam around without supervision in the countryside. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and I guess that leads us into the frequent causes of death when they did die. And, Becca, you can talk about some of the fatal accidents that you read mm-hmm. about, but the frequent causes of death are pox, flu, fever, black death, malnutrition, and infection. And you said that you read something about how they were fed, which do you want to explain mm-hmm. that?
I think this is really interesting. This also came from Barbara Hannawalt from her Growing Up in Medieval London book. And she was talking about while many children in this time period, in London at least, were breastfed, other ways that children receive nutrition, I guess, they were either fed animal milk or bread soaked in animal milk through either horns or through rags that were soaked in milk. And this kind of led to different rates of infection. And she was also saying something that I thought was interesting was that this led to also more female children dying than male infants, because this is something that I think would be interesting to explore further. But she was arguing that mothers were kind of more, they were more adamant, I guess, about making sure their young sons receive proper nutrition. And again, I think that's something that we would need to look into further to really verify. But besides kind of these methods of nutrition that led to these deaths, another thing we saw was a lot of fatal accidents. Which is really sad, but crib fires seem to be one of the major deaths for children. During this time, children were swaddled because parents thought that their bones would kind of be limp or wouldn't properly grow if they weren't swaddled when they were infants. So they were confined in swaddled clothes in these cribs, and fires sometimes happen. Other stories that we read about were girls falling in wells, and also in London, sometimes children would get run over by horses. So there were a lot of different sad instances, and I think it's important to note that fatal accidents were more common in the countryside, whereas illnesses were more common in the city. But I think, you know, as a modern day reader, we would think, like, does this indicate that parents weren't looking after their children and things like that, going along with this misconception? But it's just not true. And I think, like, one thing I'll talk about later, but parents did kind of use different methods to try to prevent these fatalities. And obviously they were still very distraught by these instances. And I think that kind of leads us into another section where we could talk about kind of the grief they experienced from their children's loss.
Yes. So there are a lot of different documents that do show that parents were apathetic and very emotionally tied to their children. And a lot of these accounts come from expressions of grief in main Europe. And also Becca's going to talk about other parts of the world in a second. But one thing that's interesting to consider is Chaucer's depiction of children in the Canterbury Tales. One tale in particular is the Prioress's Tale. It's basically set in a Christian town in Asia. This little boy, he's memorizing verses on his way to school, and he has to pass a Jewish ghetto every day on his way to school. And I think something that happens is he ends up, I'm just going to be really short with this, but mm-hmm. he gets murdered by a Jewish hire someone to murder him. So they slit his throat and throw him into a cesspool. And the boy's mother, who's a widow, there's a lot of lines dedicated to her looking for him and being really anxiety-induced and, like, agitated, and no one can really point her in the right direction to where he is. And when she finally finds him, there's kind of a really short moment where she grieves over his dead body, and then he, like, sings back to her when he's dead, which is a whole other thing that you can go explore on your own. But yeah, so there's just accounts like that in literature, and also like accounts from like royal families who are writing to each other, grieving the losses of their own children. There's a lot of evidence that points toward really strong emotional ties. And also, since we're talking about Chaucer still, I'll just add in that he dedicates his treatise on the astrolabe to his son Lewis, and he calls him Little Lewis, and then explains that he's going to explain it a little bit differently for him because he's a child, which definitely combats Ari's claim that, like, children weren't acknowledged as children. You know what I'm saying?
Right, that they were treated as mini adults or had the same, I don't know, capabilities or, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And like you mentioned before, even though the centuries of childhood, the arguments put out by Ari's argument are kind of refuted today, it was important because it did spark interest from scholars about these kind of ideas about the history of childhood, and from diverse perspectives too. So for example, Avner Gulati, he wrote a really interesting article in 1989. So it's a little older, but it's still, I think, interesting and worth the read. It was titled Concepts of Childhood and Attitudes Towards Children in Medieval Islam. And he basically was pointing to different treatises written by Muslim scholars to console bereaved parents, in order to prove, again, that parents in urban medieval Egypt and Syria were not indifferent to child mortality, and also that Islamic civilization at large kind of had a diverse knowledge about children's physical development and, I guess, their psychology and diseases specific to children. So again, that kind of links into what you were just saying about fighting this misconception that children weren't viewed as kind of a separate age group.
Right.
And I think it's just interesting to note that there are a lot of different perspectives that still come together and basically refute this argument. It's not like parents who were in England or in main Europe were the only ones who this, argument against Felipe's stance, I guess, holds true for, if that makes sense. It's kind of a universal theme. Parents still cared about their children even, 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, and I left out something, but Edward I's indifference toward the death of his child is an example that a lot of people fall back on to say, like, oh, well, if he acted really cold and seemed careless when his own child died, then shouldn't this be more representative of everyone else? But that one literary account is not representative of all the others when you compare that one to how many other accounts of grief do exist out there.
Mm-hmm.
So look into it on your own time, but it's interesting. So.
Yeah, I guess another thing I would add also from, I really like that Sophie Oosterwyck article. I think we would both say we would definitely recommend it. But I thought it was really interesting, too, because she also came from, like, the religious perspective. She was talking about how imagery and religious iconography of the virgin and child were really prevalent in the Middle Ages, obviously, but also the theme of the biblical massacre of the holy innocents, right?
So yes.
When King Herod of Judea in the Old Testament ordered the killing of all the infant males in Bethlehem. And I thought it was just really interesting because she noted, like, this theme was so prevalent, so it obviously resonated with parents and kind of proved maybe that parents identified both with maternal love and also this grief felt for a lost child because, you know, why else would artwork kind of reflect something that people didn't feel as, I guess, a natural emotion.
Yeah.
I just thought that was interesting, too.
Yeah, very good, very good.
I guess another thing we kind of wanted to cover moving on in our discussion was the way that medieval societies defined and viewed childhood. So if you look at Ari's work, Centuries of Childhood, he says, quote, as soon as the child could live without the constant solicitude of his mother, his nanny, or his cradle rocker, he belonged to adult society. So while his text, I think, kind of mostly focused on the experience in France and in Europe. I think more recent scholarship has revealed that the medieval vocabularies of childhood and kind of just their perceptions about the different stages of childhood were more varied and nuanced than we might think. So these categorizations kind of relate to medieval conceptions of the ages of man. And these were defined and popularized by the exegesis of late patristic, early medieval, and later medieval theologians and different scholars. The big ones, of course, being Augustine, Isidore of
Seville. Augustine, my boy.
We love him. And also, later after Isidore, the Persian philosopher Avicenna in kind of the 10th/11th centuries. So I would highly recommend for this topic, kind of Elizabeth Sears has a book called The Ages of Man, which was actually published last year. And I thought it was really interesting. She had talked about Augustine's text called On Genesis Against the Manichees from the 4th century. And just for context, Manichaeism was a dualistic religion that emerged in the 3rd century, which pictured kind of this cosmic struggle between good and evil. They kind of believed that everything material was bad and only, you know, the spiritual is good. And Augustine, of course, as you know, Claire, converted from Manichaeism to Latin Christianity. And that kind of makes up like a big part of his text, Confession. But basically, his text based the human life stages on salvation history and established 6 ages of toil before death. And this was called like the 6-age system, which widely circulated and influenced medieval artists as well as other scholars. So Isidore Seville kind of adopted and changed the system by adding established age limits, I guess, for each period. And he wrote about it in book 11 of his same text, Etymologies. So he defined infancy from birth to 7 years of age, and he kind of talked this is a period of learning for the infant as well, and the term actually is defined by the child's inability to speak, which...
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know how to properly pronounce it in Latin, but...
Try it.
I'm just going to go for it, infantia.
I think that's right.
Yeah, if anyone knows the proper way, please correct me. I'm trying to learn.
Let's get Bram.
Yes, we need to call him up. But basically, it was defined by the child's inability to speak, and apparently contemporary medieval folk believe that this was linked to kind of how children had their teeth weren't, like, fully grown and ordered. And then the next period that Isidore defined was childhood from 7 to 14, and this was defined by the child's purity and basically that they were unable to reproduce yet. And then adolescence ranged from 14 to 28, and youth ranged from 28 to 50. So it's much more, it's a broader category than I guess you would expect today. And then the last two kind of just related to older age. So all of these were, you know, derived from biblical passages, and they're more representative, I guess, of ideal divisions of the ages of man. But, of course, they differ from actual perceptions of, like, people in society as well as, like, what the law, how law defined children and things like that.
Yeah, so that's all really good stuff, and I think it's also a good time going off of that to discuss the different stages of childhood in, I guess, medieval Europe is what all the scholarship we read was on. So specifically medieval London and the countryside. And just kind of, I'm just going to kind of let everyone know, you know, what children were up to, you know, what they were doing, how they accidentally would, like, get crushed by horses sometimes, unfortunately. So the first years of life for a child had carefree moments, definitely. There were also a lot of games and toys, and they were heavily nurtured by their parents. But also interesting to note that, like, from a young age, children were very much expected to assist parents and other workers at home with tasks that were suited to their age and development, and they could care or help tend to the animals and maybe younger siblings, cook, maybe even help out with the business. Something interesting that we got off of medievalist.net was that tiny fingerprints were left in medieval stoneware, and that shows that children were like really involved in all aspects of family life. So I don't know. I just wanted to add that because it is interesting.
It is.
And yeah, and children were definitely susceptible to accidents, some of which include drowning, falling, hurt by animals, which I'm going to go into in a minute, as they like played and explored.
Mm-hmm.
So both urban and rural children did spend the first year of their life swaddled in a cradle. And this was believed to have like prevented chills, keep them safe and immobile in the cradle. And also if parents did need to like work, they didn't have to constantly carry their child with them.
Right.
And Becca, didn't you say you read something about a baby like holder thing?
Yeah, I actually thought this was really interesting. So apparently they had both slings, like, so even today how you see, I guess they would still be called slings, like the cloth wraps that parents carry their child on, but they also had something called cradle boards, which was kind of like a little backpack that they, they like strapped them in if they were going to the market or like on going to fairs or pilgrimages. And there's actually a really cool, in the Westminster Psalter from 1250, around that time, there's a artwork of St. Christopher carrying Jesus in a sling. And there's also evidence in art of these cradle boards. So I guess that's kind of how scholars can validate that parents were using these.
Other
thing I'll add, which I thought was also really cool, was these walking frames that they used. So apparently they were used both to help children learn how to walk, but also to prevent them from touching stoves and hot fireplaces, because those were also causes of injuries and fatalities. So I think that's interesting because it's both something that parents today can relate to, like children still walk around in those like bouncy little things, which are super cute. But also I think evidence is that like there was nurturing by medieval parents. And again, they were trying to prevent these injuries. They weren't indifferent to them, but that's all I wanted to mention about.
Yeah. I kind of wish I had one of those walking frames because I was kind of like a rambunctious little child. And one time I was like pulling on a towel rack in the kitchen and I was kind of hanging from it and it came unlatched. And I fell and I like busted my head open.
Oh, poor baby Claire.
Maybe I should have just been a medieval child and I could have had more.
You would have thrived.
I really would have thrived. But so that's kind of the situation for swaddling and assisting with walking and play. What I guess you call like manufactured items or fun tools, I don't know. But
sure.
So by the second or third year, as one does now, kids began walking and investigating and exploring their surroundings more, which also led to even more accidents. Like we said, kids getting run over by horses or just really freak accidents. And something else that is interesting is based on these accidents. So like, for example, like a female child having an accident in the house, like in the kitchen, versus like a little male child getting run over by a horse.
Right.
I think this is in Hannah Walt's article, but she said that there's like an early identification of toddlers with the division of labor by sex in London. So I think that's just really cool to look at all of the different case studies and see like how like labor divisions by sex was already influencing the way that these children played and mm-hmm. also died, unfortunately. But I don't know, that was probably the most interesting thing that I took out of, like, our reading for today, which mm-hmm. I don't know why, but I want to look more into that.
Yeah, I think that's super interesting. And it also seems to have applied to even the way, not only the way children played, but also what they played with.
Yes.
So we could talk a little bit about how toys were, I guess you would say, like, they were kind of gendered. So for instance, boys would often play with toy knights, which were made from pewter cast, and they became really popular in the 14th century in England specifically, whereas girls would often play with jugs. And, you know, like, I guess today children would play with little kitchen sets and things like that. So I guess that was kind of their equivalent. And they also played with dolls. So
love it.
Yes.
American Girl dolls.
Already knew that was coming. So they also really love dolls. There's a really interesting book by Constance King, which we'll also include the, like, citation for. But she was talking about how Anglo-Saxon children from poorer families, they would mostly have rag or wooden dolls, whereas wealthier families would have alabaster dolls. And later in the medieval period, they even had wax dolls, which were sold at annual fairs in Venice and Florence, which I just thought that was really interesting.
Oh, cool.
They even had wax dolls by then.
Yeah, and also, just kind of going off of that mm-hmm. from our reading, Nuremberg, Germany did become a really popular toy-producing city.
Yeah.
And, like, beginning at the end of the 14th century, small white pipe clay dolls, like the size of a fingernail, were produced. Some had circular indentations on the doll's chest or back,
mm-hmm.
which German scholars, a few have suggested, it indicates that they held coins and were perhaps gifted to children by their godparents as baptismal mm-hmm. gifts, which I will say, if we ever want to come back to childhood another time, uh-huh. doing a whole episode on baptism,
that
would be really, yeah. really fun. Yeah, that's it for me.
For sure.
Gift-giving's their love language.
Yes. But going back to kind of our discussion on toys, although we have mentioned this kind of gendered toy division, they did also play with different items that both girls and boys would play with. So they really liked ball games, and they had kites even, and board games like chess. Apparently, children loved these little gingerbread doll cookies that were, like, decorated in gold. I don't know if it would be icing, but same idea. That was sold at fairs starting in the 12th century, and they also had puppet shows there that they really loved. So there were a lot of different ways that children were playing, and I think that's important to note because, again, I think there's just, like, this misconception that because there was such high child mortality rates, unfortunately, and because they would help around with the family business or farm, like you mentioned, that that childhood was just kind of like this dark, somber time. But children, they were
right.
Playing, just like children
and
today.
Can I add something?
Yeah, of course.
It's also at the same time, like, while they did have all of these, like, toys and games and, like, you're going to talk a little bit about education, mm-hmm. but their education was, and I guess time at home by
yeah.
the fourth year was very, like, corporeal punishment heavy. So
yeah.
like, even though they did have this love for their children, it was just like a different mindset. Like,
yeah, no,
like that's
how
you instill, like, values and beliefs on a kid, which is, mm-hmm. is interesting.
Yeah. I don't remember what source I read it from, but apparently there was, like, kind of this maxim, spare the rod, spoil the child. I don't know if you...
Yes, okay, that, but, I think that,
yeah.
that was Hannah Walt.
Okay, yes, that sounds familiar. So, yeah, like, going off that, children were still disciplined and, I guess, to some degree, viewed differently. I think it's important to note, though, in the Gulati source that I mentioned, they were arguing in medieval Islamic societies, there were some, like the 14th century scholar Ibn Khaldun, who argued that physical punishment was oppressive and would basically lead children to kind of lie later in life to get out of punishment. So I think it's important to note, like you said in the beginning, that this wasn't, what we're talking about doesn't necessarily represent every single child's experience.
Right.
There's definitely variances throughout basically the medieval world. But in addition to kind of our discussion on play and how you had mentioned them helping around the house, children were also learning at the time. So Nicholas Orm is another scholar, and he was discussing how texts began to be written in the English vernacular rather than just in Latin by the 9th century in England. So by the 11th century, children, he says, were educated in public schools rather than just in monasteries or nunneries, which I'll kind of talk a little bit about that later with child oblation. But so children were learning, although again, this is, there's kind of a disconnect between boys might continue their education longer, or many girls might be educated at home instead and be taught things like managing the household and finances and things like that. I think another thing that's really interesting, though, is to mention how in Northern Europe, middle-class adolescents were often sent away to be servants for other families around the age of 12 or 14, which I actually didn't really, I've never come across that before. But apparently, medieval parents kind of encouraged this as a way to allow their children, using an anachronistic term, network. Like, I don't think they would think of it like that, but basically,
LinkedIn.
Yeah, they're on LinkedIn. but basically, to kind of connect with their patrons. But at the same time, it was also a way to cut their own family's household costs, of course, because it's one less mouth to feed, I guess. And also to discipline unruly children. And there were many variations. So, for example, in England, boys from wealthier families, they might continue their education, or they might even work as pages or retainers at aristocratic households, where they would learn things like proper manners, or sometimes even learning how to fight, I guess, as a knight, or just learning military crafts.
I want to do that.
Right? That sounds fun. and then I guess it's important to note, poorer families, they weren't able to afford to send their children on apprenticeships as often. So children from these economic backgrounds might, like you said, take on more work at home with farm work or crafts or just chores in general. So there's a lot of different, I guess I would just say, you know, medieval adolescents look different for every child.
Right. Yeah, and one thing I will add is, mm-hmm. I read this, like, my sophomore year, but, mm-hmm. like, while the, like, apprenticeship system was so prominent and stuff, it's still good to acknowledge that the system did kind of fail the children at times, because,
right.
like, children being away from their families were, like, more subject to, I guess, mm-hmm. random accidents, and also, like, if they did get sent to a place and it ended up not being very child-friendly, like, it could just put the child in a bad atmosphere, or
right.
maybe too susceptible to the corporeal punishment. So, like, mm-hmm. I guess we could say child abuse, but...
Yeah.
Our version of child abuse is definitely a little bit, like, they didn't view it like that. Corporeal punishment was, like,
right.
definitely, like, part of what they were doing. But, I mean, it's still important to think about how it wasn't this perfect system
right.
all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think, if I remember correctly, some apprenticeships could last up to, I want to say, 7 years, if that's
oh,
right.
Oh, wow.
So that's a really long time to be stuck in that kind of situation, I guess.
Right.
So, yeah, that's important for, I'm glad you brought that up. And then I guess one other form of adolescent experience, I guess, that I would want to mention is child oblation. So some families, instead of sending their children to be servants or to go for apprenticeships, they would dedicate their children to monasteries. So oblate comes from the Latin word oblatus,
Ooh.
I don't know if I said that right, but and that means one offered up. So I think it's kind of important to, I'm not just saying that just because, just for funsies, but
for funsies.
I think it highlights, again, trying to fight these misconceptions. It wasn't just a way for parents to get rid of children they didn't want or couldn't afford, right? So for many parents, it could be out of religious devotion because children were viewed as pure and dedicating them to the religious life was kind of perceived as a pious gift to God in the Christian tradition. But these children would also receive a good education at the monastery, and they would be provided kind of the simple necessities of life, even though they would have to live under varying degrees of strict rules. And I think one source I would recommend is Mick DeJong's has a book called In Samuel's Image, Child Oblation in the Early Medieval West. And she really argues that child oblation was not abandonment, and kind of any argument today that portrays it as just a parent trying to get rid of their child is basically anachronistic and just untrue.
Right.
I guess just to give some background on the practice of oblation, this was predominantly a reality in Benedictine houses. So the original Benedictine rule allowed for child oblates. In chapter 59 of the rule, there was a stipulation basically requiring parents to wrap up a letter stating their intention to dedicate their child, and they would wrap it around an altar cloth around the child's hands. And parents were also allowed to donate funds with their child. But there was kind of some, I guess, contention with this practice because there wasn't any clear, I guess you could say, canon law for a very long time. There were differing versions of whether that child would be allowed to leave because, of course, if you're donated as a child to, if you're gifted to a monastery as a child, you might grow up to resent it and, you know, it wasn't your own will. It wasn't your choice to go there if your parents are choosing that for you.
Right.
So that could kind of lead to scandal and things like that. As well as in the 11th century, noble families would sometimes use it as a way to maintain their noble status, right? So if you're donating your child, gifting them to this monastery, you're donating funds as well, they might hope that perhaps, like, if their child would one day become an abbot or abbotess, I'm really on the struggle bus, that would basically help them out later. Or, you know, if their daughters became a nun instead of marrying, the family could keep their land instead of abdicating it to their spouse and things like that. So there's definitely many different levels to this. So I think it's interesting, and I think we could have a whole episode devoted just to that. So I won't say anything more on it.
I will add one more thing. There are a lot of, like, literary and, I guess, mystical accounts of young girls who, like, actively want to, like, I guess, quote, like, marry themselves to Christ and, like, have that ceremony. Right. And if you want to learn more about that, I highly recommend The Life of Christina of Marquiate. It basically, she eventually becomes, like, prioress of St. Albans, just outside of London, but she wanted to be married to Christ, but her parents were forcing her to marry someone else, and they actually, like, staged rape a few times, like, to kind of, like, solidify the marriage, but she always escaped, and she ended up, like, going to live with a hermit, and it's kind of a, like, hagiographical account, so it's not super, like, historically accurate. There's different, like, scholarship that argues how historical it is, but that's just something interesting to think about, too, that, like, children actively wanted to devote themselves at the same time, but...
Right. Again, many levels, and it's hard to summarize everything in this podcast episode, but I think that's a great place to kind of wrap up, unless there's anything else that you wanted to mention on that.
Nope, I think that's it for me. I will say We do have some exciting episodes planned.
Yes.
With some very exciting guests lined up. Not going to mention who it is because want to keep everyone on their toes. but yeah, just we'll post some updates on Twitter and our website, which you can visit at nightschoolmedieval.wordpress.com, and you can follow us on Twitter at nightschool_. Yeah, so if you want to know where we got this information or you want to see a recap of the episode, just go check it out.
Yeah. All right. Sounds awesome.
All right. See you next week.
All right. Thanks, guys.